Learning from Stories, a lecture by Idris Shah, delivered in 1976 before a live audience.
When I was giving a lecture not long ago, I was talking about the difficulty which many people have in taking things in, especially if these things are delivered to them at any speed, and how even a story or a statement had to become a person's property so that it could be recalled to mind for many purposes in order to teach oneself successive layers from this story or to illustrate situations which one would otherwise find difficult to understand. And I continued in my customary brilliant way that it has been noticed that much information is not absorbed because many people cannot really absorb something when they've heard it only once. Well, immediately a hand went up in the front row, so we didn't have the front row there reserved for the rather more intelligent members of the audience, and a fellow asked me, would you mind saying that again? Well, you might say people get the audiences they deserve, but that is ridiculous. Now, I also made it my business to find out whether he was a comedian or insane. But no, he wasn't any different from you or me, whatever that may mean. This knowledge of the time lag and the perception of it between the telling of a story or the happening of an event or the realization of something and its integration into one's own mind and its digestion into one's own psychology has itself to be learnt. This is one thing which most people don't realize. They're either laugh at a gag and dispose of it, or they understand what it means, or they take its moral application and, as it were, abolish it. They do not take, in general, any interest in this question of the digestion of the impact. We even have stories to explain stories. We even have stories to explain this time lag. We have this story, for example, which we use for this, which I'm now going to tell you, of time and pomegranates. This is a story about a young man who wanted to become a doctor, and in the traditional sort of way in the Middle East, he had to be apprenticed to a doctor. Finally, he found a doctor who would take him on, and he sat with the old man. Of course, the wise man always is old in those parts, because they haven't got the benefit of the sort of speeded up process which we are now giving you, which we have pioneered. And he sat with this old man, and the old man wouldn't let him treat any patients, you see, and years passed. Finally, he said, "Master, let me treat a patient." And the old man said, "No, you're not ready." He said, "Please let me treat you." "But all right then, we'll lose a patient, but maybe it's worth it." So, a few days later, they were sitting outside the place where the old man had his office, and a traveller patient coming limping along the road. And the old man said, "Now look, I can see." He was a terrific diagnostician. He says, "I see what that man needs. There's something wrong with him. He needs pomegranates to cure him." "Well," the young man said, "now's my chance. All right, you've done the diagnosis. You let me do the therapy, as it were, or prescribing." So the old man said, "All right, but it isn't going to work." So as the patient came near, the salutations were exchanged. The patient sat down, and the old man said, "My assistant will deal with you." So the patient adopted a suitable posture of respect, and the young man said, "You need pomegranates." The patient jumped up and he said, "Pomegranates is indeed absolute rubbish. I've never heard of this, so ridiculous in my life." And he went off. So the young man said, "Whatever happened? I mean, you did need pomegranates, and what about the, you know, the authority which we have, and we are doctors, and I knew, and you told me?" And "Oh," said the young man, "you don't know anything about medicine, really. You don't know anything about people. You really don't know anything about anything." Well, the young man said, "What am I going to do?" He said, "Just watch me. You haven't been here long enough." So the next time, the old fellow says, "Right, I'll tell you the next time a pomegranate's case comes along, sir." Sure enough, a few days later, there's a fellow limping along the road. They're sitting outside this place. The old man says, "There it is, another pomegranate's case coming up, sir." And he arrives. The old man makes him welcome, gives him a cup of tea, sits him down, asks him about his friends and his wives and his children and his crops, and they talk, and then he says, "Will you sit down? I'll make an examination." He makes an examination, and he says, half goes into a trance. The doctor says, "Ah, now let me see, you need something. something sweet but not too sweet, something with sacks in it, something, yes, I have it now, honey. Pomegranates. And the patient said, oh, doctor, thank you so much. Yes, of course, I need pomegranates. And he was cured. So when he went away, the young man said, look, you told him pomegranates, and so did I. Ah, said the old man, you see, he needed time as well as pomegranates. So this element is very important. We find this element to be very important. I only bring it to you as I am your token Oriental here. Because of microphone being here, I cannot assume lotus position totally, but nevertheless, and neither can I hover 3 feet in the air, because that will give you the wrong idea about me. So, as a token Oriental, I have to say that you have brought us radio and plastics and computers and speed up things. We've got to bring you a few slow down things, like time and pomegranates, but it is my hope that we can introduce these things to you along with your other preoccupations. In other words, we don't want to slow you down and say, come on to our pomegranates outfit. We want to try and include something. That's the reason for the story. Now, it's interesting to know that sometimes when I've told that story without much context, like I've been stumbling around at these last few minutes, people, of course nobody in the United States, but in less advanced Western cultures, have said to me, well, maybe they've laughed, but then if I haven't told them why I think the story is valuable, from experience and from tradition and all the other things, they have said more than once, oh, that patient was a real idiot, wasn't he? Now, this is a method adopted and unconsciously carried on in the West by people, largely unconsciously, to abolish the impact of anything. So whereas people are always saying, I've got to experience it, I want the real thing, much of their behavior, if you watch them, tends to be attempting to abolish things. Now, this is something which abolish the full impact of something, or, equally importantly, the possible range of impacts and interpretations of a thing. That's why in the West and in those countries mainly influenced by Western thinking, systematic thinking, valuable though it is, we have so much oversimplification. I nearly said totalitarianism, that's not the word. oversimplification. Either or. You know, what kind of business is this guy in? You know, what, if you're so clever, how come you're not rich? And we want to try and restore something. So the next point I have made is the abolition of impact. We are trained to abolish, to absorb impacts, and to abolish their effect on us, salutary or otherwise. This is something you see all the time in newspapers and other media, and even in interactions with people. You say something to somebody and they answer you by a wisecrack, which may be very funny, you can share it, it makes your life feel meaningful. But on the other hand, sometimes when you're thinking over what you've said or what you could have said or what it meant, you find there are all sorts of dimensions in this conversation which could profitably have been pursued at the time. Now, this ingredient is very much present in stories. We tend to tell the difference between a well-educated or a well-developed person and a bit of an idiot by whether he does see these internal dimensions in the stories or not. I've found very few instances of stories being misunderstood as dramatic as the one which followed my first publication in 1969 when I published the book called The Book of the Book, an ancient narrative which was about reactions to stories. It was about books, about reactions. Now, it had 1,500 words in it, and they were well spaced out, and they only occupied 9 pages out of 240 in the book. It was well bound with a gold embossed cover. And I retold in this book the legend of the man who had a very big book with only very few words in it, and the words being concerned with how people judged by appearances and confused the container with the content and didn't even take any notice of the content because of the container, which might outrage them. And of course, it did outrage and enrage book reviewers who looked for the 244, or whatever it was, 229 printed pages. They couldn't stand it. That's one reason why I'm scheduled to talk to you for however long it is, this filibustering that I'm doing right now, because if I talk to you for 3.5 minutes, which is probably the time I could conceivably communicate in, I think a lot of people want their money back. Of course, not that you won't want your money back anyway by the time I've finished, but I mean, we have a rather a different attitude towards these things. Now, it got even worse, you see. There was there was an outcry about it. Reviewers at first didn't notice that it was a book about people who showed rage and disappointment when they were faced with a book like this. And so they wrote, it's still in print, and it's now in its 4th edition. Now, a bookseller sent it back saying they wanted a complete copy and that it's really true, and that their buyers were furious. We published another impression of it with a jacket on it which explained in the back what the book was supposed to be, and it didn't stop the stuff coming back in shoals from the outraged public who buy their books by weight, apparently, or something like that. Now, right? Then one reviewer got the point. He wrote a review saying this is a very clever book, so you couldn't stop the sales then, and everybody was writing. As it got... It's quite unusual for books to get reviewed on in their second, third, and fourth impressions and so on, because the reviewers don't do that because they think that they will be thought to be fools if they haven't spotted it the first time round. But now they started reviewing it again. What is actually going on? I mean, is anybody learning from this? I'm now going to write a book about the reviewers' reaction. But the British Museum, which is one of the statutory libraries in Great Britain where the book was first published, is entitled to receive one copy of, by law, must receive one copy of each new book. The publisher sent the statutory copy to the British Museum, and it was returned with a note saying the British Museum had determined that this was not a book at all. So, now, you should remember the British Museum is a very reputable, venerable institution, and any kind of a certificate from the British Museum is worth something. I mean, you take them an ancient Japanese teapot or something, and if they say, we have determined that this is or isn't, I mean, it's already something. Very often they won't bother to reply at all. So we can prove that it isn't a book at all. But in order to get it copyrighted, it had to go into the British Museum. So what are we going to do? Catch 22. Well, there's nothing higher, as you all know, than the British Museum in Britain. Of course, there's no written constitution. There's agitation for one now. But there's nothing higher than certain godlike institutions in various areas, and the British Museum is one of them. So nobody knew what to do, and it was me, by a sort of bit of luck and non-sequential thinking or something, I said, after all, Britain is a signatory to the UNESCO Convention. Let's see what UNESCO says. Damn me, excuse me, but if UNESCO had not specified in writing what a book is. So now we actually know what a book is. The British Museum, going by kind of case law, says this is not a book because we say it isn't a book. So you can't pursue them there. But of course UNESCO, being much more bureaucratic and having to write everything down, and apparently a book is something with at least a certain number of pages in it, nothing about the print. They haven't thought of that. And it's bound. And the British Museum, so you have standing before you, ladies and gentlemen, no less than somebody who has triumphed over the British Museum. I took this UNESCO document to them, and they said, oh, well, yes, well, be that as it may, which is an old English phrase for, you've got me. So now it's copyrighted. Why I'm talking like this, if it's still mysterious to any of you, is that we have a very strong sense of the container and the content, of the reality of a thing, and different realities of the same thing, which we believe helps to develop the human being's understanding, his education, even his health, mental and physical health. That's one reason why I'm here today. We don't find that this analogical way of thinking is very well developed or represented here. At the moment, there isn't much cash value in it in the West, unless one were to write a book, How to Get $1 Million in Your Sleep by Analogical Thinking or something. That's the way we could merchandise it, but so far nobody has. But it has got an interesting dimension, which, as one becomes more familiar with it, can be observed in situations almost everywhere. And therefore you learn, thus you learn. You don't even have to be, as it were, in the classroom or in a clinic, because by having a certain frame of mind, attitude towards things, you learn from the feedback of the situations. These stories very often provide you with that paradigm. I can't be any clearer than that. The key to the use of the stories is that you shall not regard them as only jokes, or only entertainment, or only great wisdom, or only single, what I call eureka systems, things, keys, things which must be applied. For instance, you must give everybody time and pomegranates always, as it were, although that's the only way to success. So what we're really looking for is a more versatile person, or the same person who will become more versatile. We believe that we do this. This is summed up, of course, in what may seem at first sight to people, particularly in the West, as being a rather archaic terminology and peculiar Eastern phraseology. We say things like, things which have a mental form also have a physical equivalent. You see, and people say, ah, yes, Plato. Well, that's abolishing it straight away in our book. Now, if the container is the human being, the content may be called the nature and quality of what we call his inner self. There's no harm in calling it his inner self. You don't have to go any further to specify it. We predicate, we suggest that there is such a thing. And we say that the nature and quality of this inner self, whether you might call this his psychological self, his educated self, or his spiritual self, or any other kind of a self, is the key factor. Sometimes you can see the literal disparity between container and content displayed almost like a moral lesson, but not as a moral lesson, in the operation of the stories and the events, which are found, I believe, in their greatest development in the Sufi tradition. Although you can be quite sure that relics of this, detritus of this, are to be seen in almost every culture. However, I'm not responsible for any of that. So the teaching stories and the teaching narratives, I call the narratives those which aren't particularly, don't have a story form, but rather like pomegranates. It's an interchange between two or more people, that these are frameworks. Once you have made them your property and you can think into them and think in terms of them, taking, for instance, from time to time, different parts, like a psychodrama or something, of the participant yourself, then you develop, and this can be and is taught even to children, you develop the capacity to be more flexible and to understand many more things about yourself, about situations, about life, to become, in fact, more integrated into life as well as being able to stand aside from it at will. Here's an example. You don't really need your teaching stories from a hoary old tradition, the old men in funny hats in the Himalayas. I was born in the Himalayas. I've just realized that that has great cash value in the United States. I never thought anything of it before, because there are so many people there. But you were born in the Himalayas. But I'm sort of trying to get out of the Himalayas to tell you something about. And somebody once said to me, not so long ago to me, it's all right for you, you can laugh at the Himalayas, you were born there, I had to go there to get my wisdom. This is just a form of snobbism, like they're always saying to you in England, it's all right for you, you've got a posh accent, you could get a job any day, but look at me, you see, I don't speak English, But the thing is, this is a sheer rationalization, because some of the richest and most successful people in Britain cannot speak their own language at all, as I've often noticed. Here's an example of the container and the content. I saw in the London Times an example of this, which, if one had been alerted to it, one would have been able to take one's nourishment, as it were, one's reaffirmation and one's reinforcement of the principle so that one could continue to apply it, because it had been pushed out in front of one again, just from a newspaper. Now, one local authority in a British county had received a parcel on which they had to pay a heavy excess postage charge because there was no stamp on it, is the report in the Times. Now, it was so badly packed that it had burst open in transit, this parcel. Now, inside this very interesting package, this container with such a disastrously negligent outwardness, what do you think there was? Not enough postage, no postage. Badly packed, smashed by the post office. What was inside it? Well, when it was opened, were 200 leaflets from the post office entitled, "Have you any complaints about the post office?" See, we can treat it as a joke, but once you've used the joke part, it's rather like drinking your orange juice in the morning. I mean, it tastes good, doesn't it? But does it stop there? This is what our stories are for. There's another one. 2 years ago, it was stated, I have the reference, that scientific tests, well, we all know about scientific tests, however, don't stop me now, had been carried out on the characteristics of various breakfast cereals and their containers. Rats in laboratory conditions were fed on diets of both separately, the container and the contents. I have the reference. You know what they are, what the result is, of course. The results indicate, and I quote, that the box cardboard is often more nutritious than the cereals inside. We use these stories and jokes for a lot of reasons. Now, when a Sufi is trying to teach his pupils, his main job is not to acquire the sort of ascendancy over them which makes effectively them consumers of his sanctity and marvelous brains. And he is an instrument. So these jokes are often used to enable the people to acquire a more constructive perspective to the whole situation. That's where you can, how you can tell the difference between what we would call a Sufi school and, a power system. Yes, master, no master is a power system. But the person who can still keep in contact with you, say, if you were studying in that way, without requiring you to worship him, to consume something, would be, according to us, a legitimate teacher. So there's the use of jokes. Now, I don't think this will work everywhere, because it's traditional, both in the East and the West, that the big tycoon, for instance, is somebody before whom you must not make a joke. You only laugh at his jokes. You worship him. But that's a power system. We believe there are other things in life than power system. We also believe that you can be in them, but not of them. You could be in a power system, but you would also be able to educate yourself and or others aside from that. You couldn't do it with a tycoon, of course, and we don't have that kind of power. Now, there's a serious problem about stories which are used for religious, didactic purposes, inculcation of morals, and making people attached more to the systems to which these stories appear to belong. And that is that the stories themselves, or the manner of their purveying, imparting, usually tends to help reinforce the system itself and not the teaching which is contained in the stories. That is not characteristic of our method. That's why we repeat we are educational and therapeutic, as it were, and not a power system. Now, this is very strongly marked in the West, because in some peculiar way that I haven't been able to discover, Western people seem to equate servility with good manners, as it were, in the face of somebody who is teaching them, especially when we have this Oriental type thing, with some exceptions, of course. And there is a Western story, which is given as a joke, but I want to reclaim it for learning purposes, about this. You've probably heard it, but do let me tell it, because I like it. There was this fellow, you see, he came from the West somewhere, you see, which to us means Europe and America mostly, by the way, not California, where I've recently been. And so, of course, he had to go to the East to seek spiritual enlightenment, of course. And finally he arrived at the dwelling of a sage who was reputed to be a master of secrets and so on, purveyor of enlightenment. And the precise moment that he was ushered into the presence of this great man, a strange agitation seized him, and he fell to the ground. He felt that the very earth might open and swallow him up. And he felt as though he'd been illuminated, and he stammered, "Master, master, at last you have stirred my inmost being, master of spiritual secrets." "Well," said the teacher, "I'm afraid I don't quite understand how you can imagine that you can benefit from what was, in fact, only an earthquake." Now, we do get a lot of them round about here, you know. This is something we must avoid at all costs. It is not unknown in the East. And unfortunately, just as we in the East have imported your worst things, you have imported our worst ones. You've imported our spiritual masters who work this way. I want to tell you that there's an educational, a psychological, and a spiritual way which, of which these grotesques, of which you may have heard and at which you may have quite rightly laughed, are not representative. You can see from some of this that I am making another point, too, that the Sufi educational techniques aim at removing or helping to remove superficial behavior pattern barriers to deeper understanding. That's really what I'm saying. If your behavior pattern is to break up and laugh and roll in the eyes whenever I say something, are you going to really see what other content it might have? Even if that behavior pattern is politeness. If your behavior pattern is to think, oh, Master, aren't you marvelous when faced by a spiritual guide or something? Are you going to be able to obtain what he has to impart, he, she, or it has to impart? I doubt it. Similarly, the confusion which you have, I think, in the West, and we have probably given you from the East, the confusion between emotion and spirituality. This churns me up, it must be good, is something that has to be put right. But not necessarily by all of us becoming totally insusceptible to emotion, but wallowing it is another thing. Right, so here we have to remove, or stand aside from, at least temporarily, becoming a prisoner of emotion, or going into these episodes of systematic behavior, whether they be worshipping gurus, or laughing at jokes, or believing that we are being good, or sincere, or right, or whatever, when we're not. So here we have a very important thing to notice. What I noticed in spending some time in the West, I noticed a lot of, is that people tend to copy. There is an automimetic tendency. People will copy the limp of the man who teaches. I remember a lady came to me and I had a talk with her and there were some cigarettes on the table, and 5 weeks later she telephoned me and said, "Now, I didn't smoke before you told me to. I'm up to 50 a day. What do I do? Won't you smoke?" Now, that happens very much in the West, and I see this sort of behavior very often, not just in teaching and learning, but in all sorts of ways. People copy each other all the time. Now, this militates against the emergence of a diversity of personality or individuality. And that is why people say, "Oh, Smith or Schwarzheimer, whoever it is, he's an original. They don't make them anymore like that. They've rubbed a mold," all that sort of thing. But why not? Who's making them? You are. They can only be made if the conditions are right, and you are part of the conditions, and your thinking is part of the conditions. We have a story about that, and I think it's quite a sort of arresting one. So we do have at our disposal an enormous quantity of this material which we can recall to mind, and which very often prevents, it doesn't inhibit as it were, but it prevents us from making those kind of mistakes, some of us anyway. Now, there's this fellow who applied to a teacher somewhere in the Middle East to become his disciple, but he was rejected as not being ready. So he decided he'd learn by direct methods. This is the Western way, actually. He said, "I'm going to make him teach me. I'm going to find out." So he heard that a disciple was being initiated that evening. He climbed on the roof of this fellow's house and he listened to what he was being told. And he heard the teacher giving him the word, telling him what to do. And this teacher was saying to him, "Do not walk on the left-hand side of a street. Do not avoid a fortunate person. And do not push yourself forward before others. Now go." I sent him away until he had to come back for his next bit of teaching. I said, "Well, this fellow who'd been rejected, of course, says, there you are, there you go." So, he proceeded, quite obviously, to apply these things to his own life. Well, he was walking along the right-hand side of the street. A plant pot fell from a balcony and he was injured, but he made friends with a prosperous merchant. Do not avoid a fortunate person. And all that happened was that this merchant swindled him and lost all his money. Finally, he said he had no money, he had to get a job. He applied for employment, but there weren't many jobs, and he could never even get as far as the interview because he'd been told, "Do not put yourself forward before others." Well, the tale continues now to say, why did he not realize that the instructions were prescribed, scripted? These instructions were for the person who had been assessed, as it were, who had been diagnosed. Because he didn't. He concluded that the Sufi teacher was a fraud. Well, that's the commercial. But it was because he wasn't ready for measured diagnosis and prescription that he hadn't been taken on in the first place. So, I mean, the end of the story is sure to be as it turned out. Now, these story structures, in addition to displaying common features of human action, have two major functions. The first is to provide these indications of the barriers to learning that I've referred to, and the second is to place in the hands of the student the means to administer, to a very great degree, self-correction through feedback and constant monitoring and adjustment to his behavior as he sees it reflected through the structures of the stories in himself and in the world at large, in his readings, in his encounters, and so on. These tales are actually used instead of community disciplines. These are your discipline. The reason for this is that the Sufis believe that community discipline becomes a straitjacket. Now, like any other instruments, these tails can be misused, and when, as is not unfrequently true, both the supposed teacher who tries to apply the stories from, say, books mechanically, without having first exorcised the mechanical way of laughing at stories or using them to intimidate people, and the would-be learner are not operating within the kind of frame that I am trying to describe to you. Now, here's a passage which indicates one side of the situation, which then obtains. Someone asked a wise man, he said, "I've heard that humanity is suffering from an ailment which prevents men and women from seeing truth, from knowing themselves. What is the main symptom?" And the old man says, the wise man said, "The first symptom is to believe that one is not suffering from this illness at all. And when it really starts to take hold, the patient may agree that he is ill, but he now insists that the disease is anything other than it really is." Now, we find a very strong correlation between this argument and the situation which we find among those people in the West who believed at one time that they had the answers to everything and now suggest that they believe that the answers are anything which others believe they really are. Now, this kind of teaching takes place within a system which is more often than not indirect. So it's the spin-off of a secondary element in the story, just like the nutrition in the orange juice, which really has the effect. It's the calories in the orange juice or the vitamin C, which has the physiological effect, whereas it's the taste which has the whatever the other effect is. This is, therefore, the effect of these stories and of this study, and even of the kind of talk I'm giving to you now, are these effects are often unperceived. These secondary effects, which we call the primary ones, are very often unperceived at the moment of their operation. This we do find to be a constant fact. So that's why Sufis very often say, "I have come here to bore you to death." I could take refuge, if you like, in recent work which has been done in England, which has shown that school children, contrary to all previous belief, remember movies and other things which were played to them, which they had judged to be boring, and not the ones which they judged to be exciting, because they remembered the event, but not the content of the communication. So this is another interesting line, which I am trying to advise you to follow up. Now, this indirect effect is really very powerful. In our teaching situations, it's so powerful and so important that when we come across theologically organized Sufi teaching entity with the beards and the turbans and caps and bells and the rosaries and the incantations and so on, we very often realize that we are in the presence of a deteriorated though stabilized sociological phenomenon, not a spiritual or educational one. This is very far from general Western belief, or indeed superficial Eastern belief on this subject. And yet, information about this matter abounds in our literature, much of which has been translated into English. Now, the great teacher Jalaluddin Rumi tells this story to illustrate this in his Masnavi, which was published in the 1270s, where he tells the story about the merchant. And this is an answer to a question somebody wanted to say. He says, "Master, why am I not learning anything? What am I doing here? I listen to music, or I take part in dervish dancing, or I listen to your poetry, or I do this and I do that. I want to learn how to be or to do whatever." And he said, "Well, it's the story of the Indian bird. Once upon a time there was a merchant, and he had a parrot from India. And he was going to go to India, this merchant. And he said to the parrot, 'Well, I can't take you because you're a prisoner, but I'll take a message to your relatives, the parrots of India, if you like.' And the parrot said, 'Well, all right, just tell them that I'm a captive here and that you are my master, and that's all.' So the merchant went, and when he came back, the parrot said to him, 'Did you see my relatives?' And he said, 'Yes, but I haven't got very good news for you, because I went to a jungle and there were some parrots. They looked just like you. And I said, "Are you the kith and kin of such and such a parrot?" And here they said, 'Yes.' So I said, 'Well, I have to tell you that he's a captive and I'm his master. He lives in a cage in my house, and that he's alive and well, but I couldn't bring him because he's a prisoner.' And at that," said the merchant, "one of your relatives, the shock must have killed him, because he suddenly kind of jackknifed and he fell to the ground, apparently dead. At this, the merchant's parrot immediately did the same, and the merchant opened the cage and shook him, and the parrot just decided to put him out on the windowsill, and the parrot flew away onto a branch of a tree. And that's what we call indirect teaching. He got the message. It isn't possible, I don't believe anyway, that it is easy anyway, to communicate this kind of teaching without some kind of this kind of learning system, without some kind of a context. You can't just throw it at people, they've got to get used to the idea. That's my alibi for publishing a million words in 9 years. Again, relying on the British press, I have to tell you there's a story which illustrates this. It's a true one. There was a jeweler in Birkenhead in Cheshire in England, and he wanted to get people into his shop. He handed out 3,000 stones to people in the street. He had them handed out. They all looked like real diamonds, but all but four of them were glass. A leaflet was given to each person who was given one of these putative diamonds, and on the leaflet it says, among these stones there are real ones. Anybody who gets a stone of any kind is invited to visit the jewellery store, that's to get them in, you see, for promotional purposes, to find out if you've been lucky. If you have, the jewellery will be set free of charge. Now, out of the 3,000 people getting the stones, only one, a woman, actually turned up at the shop. She was right, by the way, she had a genuine diamond. All the rest of the people, presumably, believed that they had fakes. And the real diamonds had been as quickly discarded as the spurious. It's very difficult to explain to people things which they do not think they need to know. And I also say this because of sentimental reasons, because of Jalaluddin Rumi, the great 13th century Sufi teacher, said to a person who is not a jeweler, a jewel will look like an ordinary stone. So as to whether we can get this sort of idea across and make it useful in your culture, it depends very much on whether you are prepared to familiarize yourself with these approaches. I have found in European countries that it is possible, but I have not found the degree of enthusiasm for it which normally accompanies the belief in the West that something is really worthwhile. That is for the 6 weeks until the next thing comes up. These stories constitute a body of knowledge and instrumental teaching, as I've said. But they are used on what you might consider, if we're being very intellectual, a low level, teaching children. I was brought up by means of these stories. My children are brought up on them now. And we find that these do have a therapeutic type of effect. They do help the child on the lowest level, for instance, to rationalize his situation away, or when things become too tough for him. And there are lots of them. Millions of people for thousands of years have been brought up in them. But the sort of story, for instance, which we tell children is, which is a very common one, here's a story which we use in our teaching, and we also use it with our children for reasons which you'll see in a minute. We don't make this distinction, as it were, between Aesop and Hans Christian Andersen. So this is one kind of story and that's another, or the Brothers Grimm, this is a folk tale, or such like things. Or The Hobbits, this is a recent piece of literary work. We don't do that. We look for the content in the story. And having been interested in stories for so long, having professional story mongers, as it were, we can tell. And I think you can too, if you are willing to spend the time on it, and to discard the approaches which abolish your ability to see these other structures in the stories. Here's this little story. And a chap goes to a tattooist, and he says, tattoo on my back a lion. And the tattooist says, all right. He gets his needle and he dips it in this green ink or whatever it is. And he starts jabbing away and the man screams. The tattooist says, hold still, I'm tattooing a lion. He says, oh my God, I don't think I can stand it. He says, well, you're going to have to stand it. He says, well, what are you tattooing? He said, well, I'm tattooing the lion's nose. He says, oh, well, says the man, let's have a lion without a nose. So there's another terrible jab, and he says, I told you not to tattoo the nose. He said, but that's a lion's tail. He said, I'll have a lion without a tail. And so it goes on as a children's story until you have managed to make the child realize, it's quite easy, how foolish people can be, and also that there may be a certain amount of pain attached to something which one needs, or one may have to go through something. in order to get something else. That story is often used to reassure and quieten children and to give them something to hold on to. Some they can say to themselves, oh, well, it's like a tattooed lion, you know. And it also has other dimensions, and it is used in metaphysical teachings too, that story. So we have this continuum between the children's story and what you would call the entertainment or folklore story and the instruction story, the instrumental story. Somebody asked me on the BBC radio, I was doing an interview once, why I used so many of other people's tales, and I didn't make up any of my own, and I said that nobody had asked me for any of my own, which is perfectly true. And of course the interviewer, this is one of these sort of traps, you see, he says, or she rather said, well, tell us an original one then, I'm asking you. Well, and I told a story, one of my own fables. Now, a friend of mine was listening to the radio at the time, in his office, and he asked his secretary, what do you think of this fellow's story? And she said, no wonder nobody ever asked him for any of his stories, they're terrible. So that's the reason, which I told you before, why I don't very often give my own stories out anymore. It's what you call feedback, I think, in this country.